Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode 100. Woohoo! Let's do a happy dance. Ooh, do 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 do. Okay, well, maybe that's not, that's better for the radio. It's Monday, February 8th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, I'd like to start with a little bit of a Wayback Machine. Last spring, while the favorite estimator of COVID deaths from the White House was estimating 80,000 to 240,000 deaths, I gave my prediction or projection that in fact it would be closer to the leading cause of death than the high estimate of 240,000. Now, the leading cause of death is closer to 600,000, so splitting the difference, I was basically saying there would be at least 470,000 deaths. Well, my friends, unfortunately, this week we seem to be crashing through that amount. And in fact, we may officially reach the leading cause of death during a 12-month period. In fact, I say officially because later in this show, I will talk about a story where researchers estimate that the actual death rate from COVID-19 is 44% higher than what the official toll is. And by that, we're just about there already. Okay, well, let's start in the long overdue category. From the Hill, Biden to use Defense Production Act to boost production of COVID-19 tests, gloves, and vaccine supplies. The Biden administration will use wartime powers to significantly increase the supply of rapid at-home and point-of-care COVID-19 tests, a move some experts say could go a long way in slowing the spread of the virus. The Defense Production Act will also be used to rapidly surge domestic testing capabilities, investing money in six suppliers to produce 61 million at-home and point-of-care tests to be available by the end of the summer, said Tim Manning, the White House COVID-19 response team supply coordinator. Okay, in a moment of perspective, we are doing something on the order of 61 million tests a month, so that would be about a one-month supply. A boost, not a game changer, a little late in the game, but hey, never late than never. Okay, the Defense Production Act will also be used to increase the supply of raw materials and equipment needed to produce vaccines and surgical gloves in the U.S. The U.S. will build rubber factories and help build separate factories to make the gloves. By the end of the year, the U.S. will produce more than a billion surgical gloves a month. Currently, the U.S. is nearly 100% reliant on overseas manufacturers for its glove supply, Manning said. And I reported earlier in the pandemic about supply issues specifically related to gloves. And this is will take months before this becomes a reality, but this will... There's no problem doing prevention amid a pandemic for the next prevention and also having gloves by the end of the year. And this level of production should cover about half of the needed supply in the U.S. So it's great that the U.S. can produce on its own soil at least half of what needs as far as surgical gloves. Okay, and next up from the policy is people category. This from Stat News. Eric Lander is brilliant, connected, and controversial. Now Joe Biden wants him to, quote, reinvigorate American science. Joe Biden's presence at meetings of the Obama administration's Scientific Advisory Council sometimes tested his staff's patience. It wasn't that the vice president was unwelcome, of course. It was that Biden's tendency to linger long after the meetings ended invariably caused scheduling hiccups. From his seat across the table from Eric Lander, then the council's co-chair, Biden would pepper the group with questions about cancer research, climate change, and everything in between. On several occasions, Biden stayed until his scheduler was, quote, almost tearing her hair out, recalled John Holdren, Lander's council co-chair and President Obama's science advisor. Now, President Biden has brought Lander back in a far more influential role, White House science advisor. The selection and Biden's decision to instantly elevate the role to cabinet status comes at a pivotal moment for the future of American science and underscores the new administration's pledge to place science at the center of government. Biden has set lofty expectations, introducing Lander as a researcher whose work, quote, has changed the course of human history, and pledging that his science staff will, quote, help restore your faith in America's place on the frontier of science and discovery and hope. Lander is described by friends and associates as an engaging, uber-talented science communicator who does not suffer fools, with an ability to both envision and execute complex and ambitious scientific projects. He is not, however, without a healthy ego and has had his share of controversy, and he won't be content to serve as scientific window dressing. If Lander has an opinion, he will almost certainly voice it. He is able to explain complex science and technology issues in ways that people immediately understand, in ways that resonate, Holdren said. Obama loved him and Biden loved him. And so in my judgment, Eric Lander was, in many respects, an obvious choice. Lander has his work cut out for him. Nearly 500,000 Americans are dead from a pandemic, and swaths of the country have rejected basic science-backed measures like wearing masks. Climate change is accelerating. Government science agencies are confronted with a crisis in public confidence. A host of other issues, including the militarization of space, Chinese threats to U.S.-backed research, the proliferation of self-driving cars, and genetic data privacy will also require the White House's attention. It is clear already that Biden expects Lander to play an active role addressing each. In an open letter modeled on Franklin Roosevelt's 1941 challenge to his own science advisor to leverage science for the benefit of the country's health, safety, and prosperity, Biden assigned Lander a similarly formidable task to refresh and reinvigorate our national science and technology strategy to set us on a strong course for the next 75 years. While the Senate hasn't yet confirmed Lander to head the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, he began on January 25th as Biden's science advisor, a role that does not require Senate approval. The foundation of Lander's team is already in place. Alondra Nelson, previously the president of the Social Science Research Council, has been installed as Lander's deputy. Kai Kozemi, an expert in government science agency budgets and an Obama administration veteran, is the office's chief of staff. Amid a pandemic and a redoubled effort to confront racism in healthcare, science, and society at large, the selection of a biologist and social scientist to steer the White House science strategy is clearly purposeful. And as one of the world's leading genomic researchers, Lander is also uniquely suited to help address one of the biggest pandemic response shortcomings, a lack of capacity for viral genome sequencing, which has prevented the U.S. from detecting new variants of the SARS-CoV-2 virus before they begin spreading in earnest. And that genomic science is advancing fast, finally, in the U.S. This from the Hill. U.K. strain doubling every 10 days in U.S. The COVID-19 strain first discovered in the U.K. is doubling in the U.S. every 10 days, presenting a potential risk of increased cases and deaths in the country, according to a study released Sunday. A group of researchers estimated that the UK variant called B117 spreads at an increased transmission rate of 35 to 45% and is expected to become the predominant strain in the US by March. The study, released on a server MedRx, has not yet been peer-reviewed or published in a medical journal. Our study shows that the U.S. is on a similar trajectory as other countries where B117 rapidly became the dominant SARS-CoV-2 variant, requiring immediate and decisive action to minimize COVID-19 morbidity and mortality, the study reads. Scientists determined from 500,000 COVID-19 tests and 212 genomes at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention prediction that the UK strain would become the most prevalent coronavirus variant in the U.S. by March. Christian Anderson, a co-author of the study and virologist at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California, told the New York Times that nothing in his paper is surprising, but people need to see it. Researchers estimate the UK strain, first announced by the British government on December 20th, emerged in the US as early as November. The first case was confirmed in the US in Colorado on December 29th and has since spread to at least 33 states, according to the CDC. The strain first found in the UK was brought to the US at least 8 times on separate occasions, potentially due to increased travel at Thanksgiving and Christmas between the two countries, according to the study. The scientists anticipate that the strains make up a higher percentage of COVID-19 cases in certain states, such as Florida, where 4.5% of cases are estimated to come from the variant. As a whole, the UK variant is estimated to make up 2% of all US cases, meaning 1,000 more people may be contracting the strain every day, the Times noted. I'm not really sure. That's pretty conservative math, because if you're 2% or 1/50th, and we're getting over 100,000, that sounds like more than 2,000 a day. But either way, this is just further reinforcement of what the CDC projected a couple weeks ago, that this strain is coming. This next story comes under the scientific category of yikes from the New York Times. AstraZeneca's vaccine does not work well against a virus variant in South Africa. South Africa halted use of the AstraZeneca Oxford coronavirus vaccine on Sunday after evidence emerged that the vaccine did not protect clinical trial volunteers from mild or moderate disease caused by the more contagious virus variant that was first seen there. The findings were a devastating blow to the country's effort to combat the pandemic. Scientists in South Africa said on Sunday that a similar problem held for people who had been infected by earlier versions of the coronavirus. The immunity they acquired naturally did not appear to protect them from mild or moderate cases when they were reinfected by the variant known as B1351. Boom, there it is. The scientists said, however, that they believe the vaccine might protect against more severe cases based on the immune responses detected in blood samples from people who were given it. If further studies show that to be the case, South African health officials will consider resuming use of the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, they said. Wow, this was certainly feared, but this is the first time that we've got solid scientific evidence that in fact this variant, the B1351 coming out of South Africa, that's already present in this country, is both more contagious and seems to evade the natural immunity from other variants. So all you people who have been vaccinated by nature by getting this infection may not be protected from this new variant. And as far as you're concerned, it's practically a new virus. Now, of course, what we don't know is how disease course will be on people being reinfected. Hopefully, by being infected by earlier variants, there will be some crossover of immunity and there won't be as much serious disease, but we don't know that yet. But from a public health perspective, the scary thing here is that a population that might have been protected and taken out of the equation of infection happening in the community may be reintroduced to exposure as a vulnerable population and themselves be able to get the virus again and transfer this new, more dangerous, more infectious, and more evasive virus along. This could be, unfortunately, a supercharge of viral transmission. Yikes.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, let's get to the local update, where we have some better news. The average daily cases of newly identified infections has dropped again substantially, from 162 per day down to 111 most recently. Very good news. Testing positivity rates continue to drop. In Lucas County, they've dropped down to 9.8% from 11.5% in the previous week. This is good news because we've seen a steady drop here, although I must note that this positivity rate, which is an indicator of how much infection you have both in the community and how well you're testing for it, is still higher than the second wave we saw in the summer. So while it's going down, it's still at very high levels. But also from the state of Ohio, the testing positivity rate, the percent of people that are positive who got a test, is 7%, down from 8.1%. So we're higher locally, but both the state and Ohio are going down. Now, both Ohio and Lucas County testing volumes have declined and are now at their lowest level since October. The average of 3.4 days for a positive test result to be returned to the health department is holding fairly steady. The labs getting positive test results to individuals is slightly improving, while the time forwarding those positive test results to the health department is not. Okay, well, one of the formerly most dangerous places, hopefully much less so now, long-term care facilities or nursing homes. We saw a total of 89 active cases, down from 97 in the previous week, and that's a big drop from earlier weeks. But still, 49 residents and 40 staff have active cases of COVID-19. The positivity rate in long-term care facilities in Lucas County has dropped to 10.7%, which is still higher than what we're seeing about testing in the community, but this is down from 12.3% in the previous week. And really good news, new hospitalizations in both Lucas County and Ohio are trending down substantially, down about one-third in the last 2 weeks. And what we expect to see with hospitalizations trending down, Lucas County death rates have eased up a bit, with a total of 65 deaths in the last 14 days compared to 72 from last week. The Lucas County death rate over the last 14 days still continues to be higher than the state and national death rates, though. Okay, in UT, they've been back in class for a little while, and they're seeing slightly more cases, up to 39 identified cases. And in their random surveillance testing last week, they had a 2.2 positivity rate. Not a huge change, but seems to be trending up, perhaps. Lucas County schools, there was 128 identified infections, 84 in students and 44 in staff in the most recent week. Probably not wildly different than what's happening in the community, although that is an increase from the previous week. So, I don't know. I mean, obviously, you're getting Lucas County schools back to more in-person, so you might expect that. But it's hard to tell because we're still not doing any regular testing surveillance in the Lucas County schools. Okay, vaccines. Where are we at? In the United States, it have had over 39 million people who've gotten at least their first dose, and that's 9.7% of the population. In Ohio, we've cracked 1 million people who've gotten at least their first dose. That's 8.9% of Ohio's population. Lucas County, we've had about 41,000, which is 9.5% of the population. So like before, we're doing slightly less than the U.S. as a whole, but slightly better than Ohio as a whole. So let's keep up the good work. And an interesting thing on the school front with vaccines is that this weekend we are going to have the Toledo Lucas County Health Department setting up a big vaccination center to vaccinate about half of school employees, Lucas County school employees. And that is going to be mostly from kind of a separately allotted from the state of Ohio to the educational system, schools in Ohio, in order to get kids back in class and teachers back safely. So they will have to scrounge up a portion of that from kind of the pool of doses that would go to the broader community. But it's a priority that Ohio has set. And I'll have a little commentary on that a little bit later. But now we are definitely creating more immunity through vaccinations than infections, locally, statewide, and nationally. But of course, that's not a particularly high bar, because what we want to avoid is the infection that could potentially produce disease, the quote, naturally acquired infections. So having that roughly on even par is not exactly winning, but it's definitely progress. Okay, if you want to pre-register for vaccinations and for full info on local vaccination sites, you can go to lucascountyhealth.com. I must apologize, I misreported that website in earlier shows. If you need language assistance or have poor internet access, you can call 211, the United Way Social Service hotline. If you are over the age 65 and you need assistance, you can call the Area Office of Aging at 419-382-0624 to help register or get an appointment. Again, that's 419-382-0624. You are listening to the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life, just for the health of it. WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. Okay, and more Ohio vaccination news from Associated Press. Ohio governor says Pfizer, Moderna boosting vaccination supply. Ohio currently receives about 73,000 doses a week from each company, with Moderna expected to increase that amount to about 105,000 next week, about a 50% increase, the governor said. Pfizer officials have told DeWine that its own weekly supply of 73,000 should grow by about 40% by the middle of February and double by the end of March. So a slow and steady march forward. Okay, well, the COVID-19 pandemic has been a harsh lesson in public health preparedness, and DeWine seeks more state spending for public health causes in Ohio. This from the Ohio Capital Journal. Governor Mike DeWine wants to see the state of Ohio invest more in public health initiatives over the coming years to impact the COVID-19 pandemic response and numerous other health needs. The governor's budget proposes an increase in state spending toward the Ohio Department of Health, with investments in data reporting improvements, addiction services, pregnancy support, and addressing social inequities of healthcare access. Some of this money would benefit city and county health departments, which are mostly supported by local levies. One of the long-term goals of our administration is to build up our local public health departments, DeWine said at last Tuesday's news conference. We've ignored public health in this country for too long, and if this pandemic has taught us anything, it's that we can no longer afford to underfund public health. DeWine noted that departments have had a challenging time balancing COVID-19 contact tracing, testing, and vaccine distribution, along with its normal services unrelated to the pandemic. His proposal allocates $25 million towards improving public health data, with data reporting, with a goal to align the record systems across the state. The COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted the importance of more accurate and timely health data to improve community health programs and protect Ohio lives. The budget fact sheet reads, the state is eyeing further changes to local health departments, with suggestions that some of them share services or consolidate with one another. There are 113 local health departments across the state. Most are countywide departments, but some cities additionally have their own. The budget proposal is offering money for departments to research and plan a merger with the hope of saving resources down the road. DeWine's plan also includes various investments to help pregnant mothers, as well as an increase in funding of the Help Me Grow program, in which health department workers conduct home visits with families to provide parenting education. Well, move in the right direction, Governor DeWine. May the Republican legislature see that through. Okay, well, next up, I have a couple stories of what building back better may look like for public health. This from Stat News. Public health is being undermined. These 10 actions can restore it. Invest in public health. While the United States spends more per capita on healthcare than any country on earth, less than 3% of that spending goes to public health programs. That's at least $4.5 billion less than we need to provide an adequate level of protection, prevention, and care. One option for closing that gap would be to make public health spending a mandatory entitlement program with a blended federal and state financing system like the one for Medicaid. Bolster coordination. In addition to fully funding agencies like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Food and Drug Administration, along with state, local, and tribal health departments, they need to work in concert. COVID-19 is showing us exactly what happens when they don't. A disjointed response riddled with supply shortages, testing gaps, mixed messages, and inconsistent policies. Lack of coordination is why the virus was coming under control in some states, even as it was ballooning in neighboring ones. With that in mind, the country would benefit from the creation of an independent, non-governmental organization specifically designed to meet the public health needs of the 21st century. Enhanced global engagement. The COVID-19 pandemic is the epitome of a global crisis and a stark reminder of the need for global health cooperation. In the short term, it's encouraging to see the Biden administration re-engage with the World Health Organization and commit to joining COVAX to ensure the equitable distribution of COVID-19 vaccines to countries around the world. In the long term, the administration must support a robust global health action agenda that includes doubling contributions to the World Health Organization, supporting the reform of international health regulations, and increasing humanitarian aid. Foster public-private partnerships. One thing this pandemic has made clear is that public health cannot thrive without cooperation from the private sector, and the private sector cannot thrive without public health. Throughout this crisis, we've seen unlikely partners come together to save lives, from producing and distributing personal protective equipment, ventilators, and other supplies, to developing vaccines and diagnostic tests at record speed. Building on these public-private partnerships will help us bring innovation and efficiency to the public health challenges of the future. Build crisis capacity. This pandemic has strained the U.S. healthcare system to its breaking point and underscored our need for sustainable surge capacity. That includes investing in vaccine research and development and continually replenishing the strategic national stockpile of medical supplies so we will never again face dire shortages of personal protective equipment and other supplies. We must also alleviate the strain on hospital systems, particularly rural ones, which in many cases are already operating in the red and lack reserves for emergency scenarios. Build a modern disease surveillance and reporting system. It is impossible to overstate the importance of robust data and the ability to access it quickly, but federal agencies today must consolidate information that comes in multiple formats, including via fax, to report national and regional statistics. That wastes time and increases the potential for error. It's past time to build a 21st century information sharing system. In addition to tracking cases, the country also needs the ability to track resources like ventilators and ICU beds in real time and use that data to rectify disparities in access. Address healthcare workforce shortages. The pandemic has underscored the urgency of recruiting and retaining physicians, nurses, and other first responders in the U.S. and around the globe. Even before this crisis, which has worsened burnout rates, the World Health Organization estimated a shortfall of 18 million healthcare workers by 2030, with the vast majority of that gap affecting low and middle-income countries. Investing in health employment will be critical to advancing well-being and protecting economic growth around the world. Prioritize health promotion and disease prevention. Healthcare in the United States is actually more like sick care. Illness is treated with little attention to preventing it. This has led to unsustainable costs and poor health outcomes. Roughly half of Americans today have been diagnosed with preventable chronic diseases like heart disease, cancer, and diabetes, many of the same conditions that made COVID-19 so deadly. The U.S. has a tremendous opportunity today to shift from a reactive system to proactive health and wellness models. Doing so would drastically reduce the country's chronic disease burden, cut costs, and lead to longer, healthier lives. Address the root causes of health inequity. The heartbreaking disparities in COVID-19 deaths reflects generations of discrimination and systemic inequality, not just in healthcare quality and access, but across all facets of daily life. As much as 80 to 90% of a person's overall health is determined by factors outside of clinical medical care, such as the conditions in which we are born, live, work, and play, otherwise known as the social determinants of health. Addressing disparities in education, housing, air quality, and employment opportunities are all key to addressing health disparities. Rebuild trust, public trust in health agencies. Perhaps one of the most dangerous outcomes of the botched pandemic response has been the erosion of public trust in essential institutions. From the beginning, the Trump administration sought to discredit agencies like the CDC, FDA, and the World Health Organization. Basic preventive measures like mask wearing and social distancing became political acts, and lies, conspiracies, and scams impeded experts' ability to get factual, life-saving information to the public. Restoring public faith will be a long process, one that begins with centering scientists to provide transparent, apolitical information to people of all communities and backgrounds. All of this is a tall order, but it could not be more urgent. Between climate change, antimicrobial resistance, aging populations, and the rising of non-communicable diseases and mental illnesses, the next global health crises are already underway. And so, as we work to halt this catastrophe, it is up to us to examine the many underlying issues that led to it and leverage the undivided focus on public health to address them. When we do, we will improve well-being across the globe and save countless lives. And for another take on this from the Center for Health Journalism, here's what 8 of the nation's top health policy voices say Biden should do this year. For the last decade or so, at least until the pandemic hit, the dominant healthcare storyline has been the push to get more people covered under the health insurance tent, an effort that slowed a few years ago. As we begin a new year with health and medical news still largely focused on coronavirus, it's a fair question to ask, what should be at the top of the healthcare agenda in 2021? I put that question to 8 healthcare experts. Here are the fixes at the top of their wish list. This from Dr. George's Benjamin, Executive Director of the American Public Health Association, put building a modern, functional, and real-time information technology infrastructure for the public health system at the top of his list. He explained that the current public health technology infrastructure has been underfunded and is terribly antiquated. A new such a system would allow public healthcare data systems to talk to each other and share information. Benjamin noted that today's data systems are not interoperable, and disease surveillance systems are spotty and often incomplete. As an example, he pointed out that many local health departments often still rely on paper-based recording systems and fax machines to exchange information. He called a new system a best buy that would do the most to improve informed decision-making. From Dr. Robert Berenson, senior fellow at the Urban Institute, he noted that financially enticing or requiring the states that haven't done so to expand their Medicaid programs would be the most important. A dozen states have yet to adopt the Medicaid expansion, including massive population centers such as Texas and Florida. On the delivery side, he said, the federal government needs to develop price regulation models and incentives for states to limit prices that hospitals negotiate with commercial insurers. In the past 20 years, hospital prices have increased drastically relative to Medicare, producing unconscionably high levels of cash and investments maintained by nonprofit hospitals. Yikes. Okay, and from Dr. Michael Carome, Director of the Public Citizens Health Research Group, he suggests that to better ensure the safety and effectiveness of drugs and devices approved by the FDA, Congress should enact a firewall between the FDA staff who interact with industry reps seeking FDA approvals and FDA staffers who will be involved in actual reviews of drugs and devices. The current system of interactions with sponsors has the potential to undermine the integrity of agency reviews, Carome said. This from Lan He Chen, the David and Diane Steffi Fellow in American Public Policy Studies at the Hoover Institution. He hopes the Biden administration will make permanent some of the telehealth changes began in the Trump era by executive action. Such changes make it easier for providers to furnish telehealth services, such as diagnosing mental illness across state lines, and to provide such services at federally qualified health centers and rural health clinics. The Trump changes also increase the range of health services covered by Medicare. Without further action, these reforms will go away, Chen said. They would garner bipartisan support and would be pretty easy to do in my mind. From Timothy Jost, Emeritus Professor at Washington and Lee University, said his top recommendation for the Biden administration would be to rescind the Medicaid waivers granted by the Trump administration, some of which impose work requirements on Medicaid recipients. The legality of such work requirements is now before the U.S. Supreme Court, which will hear the case later this year. Jost would also like to see Tennessee's Medicaid block grant rescinded as well. Under a block grant arrangement, the government gives the state a set amount of money to use for health benefits. When the money runs out, low-income residents get no more benefits. Compare that with Medicare, in which all residents who qualify are entitled to a benefit. Block grants are likely to result in fewer people receiving benefits and reduce federal spending, which is why they are popular with some politicians. They save money. Yeah. When you change it from an entitlement to if we have the money. Oh man, not very consistent. Okay, from Gerald Kaminsky, professor of health policy and management at the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. He says the most important reform would be to expand the Medicare program to Americans age 60 and older instead of using age 65, the current age for eligibility. This is the step the original architects of Medicare expected to happen in the 1970s. 50 years later, I think it's time to take the next step in that original design and start expanding Medicare to the rest of the population. President Biden has voiced support for such a plan, which faces strong opposition from hospitals. And you might ask, why would hospitals oppose that, ensuring that you get paid for the healthcare services you provide? Well, Medicare pays for about half of the healthcare costs because, of course, the older population has way more health issues and more expensive healthcare issues. But if you expand that down to the next 5 years from age 60 to 65, that's that which a lot of those are, you know, basically most of those are covered by commercial insurance plans. That's the most profit because that's where most of the healthcare is delivered in the commercial sector. If that is taken over by Medicare, a much more efficient and better coverage, then they would lose a lot of money. Okay, from Jonathan Oberlander, professor of health policy and management from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, says the list of needs is so long that there's so much they need to do. He said if the administration had a magic wand, he would want them to wave it and achieve universal health insurance. It's hardly magic. Every other rich democracy has it, after all. In a category Oberlander called aspirational, he would entice the holdout states to expand Medicaid. In a category he labeled possible legislatively, he suggested making the Affordable Care Act more affordable through enhanced premium subsidies. Edwin Park, research professor at Georgetown University, McCourt School of Public Policy. He says one of the country's top health priorities should be to reverse the losses in children's health insurance coverage, citing some alarming stats. Between 2016 and 2019, the children's uninsured rate climbed from 4.7 to 5.7%. Those numbers translate into an increase of about 700,000 children without coverage and presumably without regular access to care. Park believes that number has probably gone up over the past year because of job losses and loss of health coverage during the pandemic. He noted a number of policy options that could reverse this trend. They include making it easier to enroll kids and families in public coverage, increasing the federal Medicaid matching rate to avert state budget cuts, increasing outreach and enrollment efforts, and reversing federal policies such as the public charge rule, which had a chilling effect on Medicaid participation among children eligible for the program and immigrant families. This health policy to-do list is long and challenging and perhaps unachievable in its entirety. But the way I see it, how much of the nation can accomplish will define the kind of country America will be. We have a long way to go before American claim it has the best health care system in the world. Okay, well, that's a selection from 8 top policy health policy voices. I would say, though, I noticed that out of 8... all 8 of them are male. Gee, what are the odds of that? This is another good example and the meta reporting that you'll get here that we apparently do not see it as worthy, at least this reporter from the Center for Health Journalism, not to include any female voices in health policy about what should Biden do in the next year. Hopefully that too will be corrected in the near future. Okay, well, as kind of an addendum to those two stories, I have this from the American Public Health Association, the American Journal of Public Health. This is titled, "The Estimation of the Time Needed to Deliver the 2020 U.S. Preventive Services Task Force Preventive Care Recommendations in Primary Care." So, to deliver the recommended preventive services across an adult patient panel of 2,500 patients, it would require 8.6 hours per working day, accounting for 131% of available physician time. And compared with 2003, there are actually fewer recommendations than in 2020, but they require 1.2 more physician-patient contact hours per working day. Well, this just shows the kind of capacity impossibility and the orientation of our healthcare system towards sick care. We do not have preventive health services available, and it is literally, physically not possible for physicians to deliver those services. So we need to expand the availability of either physicians or other providers in order to provide these scientifically documented as efficacious recommendations for prevention. Okay, well, while an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, care makes money way more than prevention. So I'm going to do a couple stories that show sort of how our system works, or more poignantly, doesn't work. This from ProPublica. Rich investors strip millions from a hospital chain and want to leave it behind. A tiny state stands in their way. In a David and Goliath battle, a group of Rhode Island officials and a union for hospital workers have so far stymied a multi-billion-dollar private equity fund's attempt to unload its controlling stake in a national for-profit hospital chain. Investors led by the private equity firm Leonard Green & Partners previously extracted $645 million in dividends from the investment, and the firm now seeks to leave behind another $1.3 billion in financial obligations at the chain. Okay, and next up from the New York Times in that same vein, how rich hospitals profit from patients in car crashes. When Monica Smith was badly hurt in a car accident, she assumed Medicaid would cover the medical bills. Ms. Smith, 45, made sure to show her insurance card after an ambulance took her to Parkview Regional Medical Health Center in Fort Wayne, Indiana. She spent 3 days in the hospital and weeks in a neck brace. But the hospital never sent her bills to Medicaid, which would have paid for the care in full. And the hospital refused request to do so. Instead, it pursued an amount 5 times higher from Ms. Smith directly by placing a lien on her accident settlement. Parkview is among scores of wealthy hospitals that have quietly used century-old hospital lien laws to increase revenue, often at the expense of low-income people like Ms. Smith. By using liens, a claim on an asset, such as a home or a settlement payment, to make sure someone repays a debt, hospitals can collect on money that otherwise would have gone to the patient to compensate for pain and suffering. They can also ignore the steep discounts that are contractually required to offer to health insurers and instead pursue their full charges, which, by the way, are ridiculous if you look at the rack rates. Nobody pays those except the uninsured or when these folks get around actually paying through insurance. The difference between the two prices can be staggering. In Ms. Smith's case, the bills that Medicaid would have paid, $2,500, ballooned to $12,856 when the hospital pursued a lien. It's astounding to think Medicaid patients would be charged the full billed price, said Christopher Wally, a health economist at the RAND Corporation who studies hospital pricing. It's absolutely unbelievable. The practice of bypassing insurers to pursue full charges from accident victim settlements has become a routine in many major healthcare systems across the country, court records and interviews show. It is most lucrative when used against low-income patients with Medicaid, which tends to pay lower reimbursement rates than private health plans. In a memo that surfaced in 2014 litigation, a hospital in Washington State estimated that this practice generated $10 million annually. As part of its check-in process, a Catholic hospital in Oklahoma offers some accident victims a waiver to sign stating they do not want their health plan billed for care. One patient received the waiver shortly after a car accident in which her head hit the windshield. She said she had no recollection of signing the document, but faced a $34,000 lien as a result. The way they're spinning it is, you don't want to use your health insurance because someone else caused this, said Lauren Toombs, an Oklahoma trial lawyer who represented the patient. It's clearly a business tactic and a huge issue, but it's not always illegal. Hospitals have come under scrutiny in recent years for increasingly turning to the courts to recover patients' unpaid bills. Even in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, hospitals, many of which received significant bailouts last year, have used these court rulings to garnish patients' wages and take their homes. But less attention has been paid to hospital lien laws, which many states passed in the early 20th century, when fewer than 10% of Americans had health coverage. The laws were meant to protect hospitals from the burden of caring for uninsured patients and to give them an incentive to treat those who could not pay up front. A century later, hospital liens are most commonly used to pursue debts from car accident victims. The practice can be so lucrative, documents and interviews show, that some hospitals use outside debt collection companies to scour police records for recent accidents to make sure they identify which of their patients might have been in a wreck so they can pursue them with liens. Some laws limit what share of a patient hospital what a patient settlement a hospital can lay claim to, and others allow only nonprofit hospitals to collect debts this way. Certain states require hospitals to bill accident victims' health plans rather than using a lien. This approach is seen as a more consumer-friendly because patients benefit from the discounts that health plans have negotiated on their behalf. When states have permissive hospital lien laws, some hospitals take advantage in ways that hurt patients. Those hospitals tend to be wealthier, the New York Times found out. And many of those that received hundreds of millions of dollars in federal bailout funding during the pandemic are among the most aggressive in pursuing payment through hospital lien.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, and another story, how commercial health plans gum up the system, this from the New York Times. Burned by low reimbursement, some doctors stopped testing for COVID. Dr. Robin Larrabee was thrilled to start offering coronavirus testing at her pediatrics practice in Denver last fall. Testing for children is often scarce, and her new machines could return results within minutes. She quickly discovered an unexpected obstacle, a major health insurer that paid her less than the cost of the test itself. Each kit Dr. Larrabee purchased for her machines cost about $41, but the insurer sent back half that amount each time she submitted a claim. Across the country, some doctors are seeing reimbursement rates so low that they do not cover the cost of the test supplies, jeopardizing access to a tool experts see as crucial to stopping the virus's spread. I've gone up the food chain and gotten as far as I can, and they just tell me this is the rate, she said. She doesn't use her new machines for that health plan's enrollees anymore, instead sending her test to an outside laboratory. That extra step means results take days rather than minutes to come back. All I did this summer was look at spreadsheets to figure out how much this would cost, she said. In 15 years of practice, this is the first time I've ever had to consider altering my care for a certain population. With new variants of coronavirus emerging, experts say testing will be especially important. But the low fees have led some doctors to stop testing certain patients or to forego testing altogether. The problem of low reimbursement rates appears to be most common with pediatricians using in-office rapid testing. Rapid in-office testing are less sensitive than those sent off to a lab, which means they miss some positive cases. Researchers are still learning about the efficacy of these tests in children. Still, infectious disease experts say fast turnaround tests are important in controlling the pandemic, particularly in areas where other types of testing are less available. Across the country, multiple doctors identified UnitedHealthcare and certain state Medicaid plans as the ones that routinely pay test rates that do not cover the cost of supplies. Medicaid and Medicare often pay lower prices than private insurers do, but the reimbursements from a large private insurer like UnitedHealthcare came as a shock to doctors. Many private insurers have prospered during the pandemic, with Americans delaying much medical care in 2020. As of September, insurers' monthly profit margins in large group health plans were up 24%. In mid-January, the American Academy of Pediatrics informed UnitedHealthcare of the problem its members have faced. It's still waiting a response. The California Medical Association has also raised the issue with them. Now, I want to point out for clarity that there's kind of like a hybrid of public and commercial insurance. There are Medicaid Advantage plans, the ones that you see incessantly advertised on TV. These are specialized, privatized insurance plans that actually cost the federal government and you ultimately 15% more. And they have a whole different range of, that's why it's so confusing and you need to have, you know, insurance agents try to figure it out for you and try to sell you something, which is hard to adjust. But also with Medicaid, the same way, Medicaid is often contracted out and made into a commercial health plan, and those benefits and coverage rates can vary. So this, again, if you have standard Medicare or standard Medicaid, you may, you know, it's standard. But when you start breaking it up into these dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of commercial variants, it takes a long time to figure out what's going on for providers and consumers alike. Money, 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 follow the money. Well, here's a story from the other side. That is for individual and family incomes from the Public Health Newswire. Another benefit of raising the minimum wage? Better U.S. health. Raising the minimum wage is often thought of as an economic issue, but as higher wages are linked to better health and well-being, particularly for vulnerable populations, the minimum wage is also an important issue in public health. On January 26th, a group of congressional leaders introduced the Raise the Wage Act, which would gradually raise the federal minimum wage to $15 by 2025. The bill would increase wages for nearly 32 million Americans, including a third of all black workers and a quarter of all Hispanic workers, according to the Economic Policy Institute. As most minimum wage workers are women, it would also narrow the U.S. gender pay gap. Income and poverty are key determinants of health. Raising the wage reduces risks of early childbirth, dropping out of high school, and premature death. Public health advocates have long supported raising the minimum wage. And in another example, how social determinants of health affect our health, and this particularly for the COVID-19 epidemic and getting a vaccine appointment, this from Science Daily. Digital health divide runs deep in older racial and ethnic minorities. A study led by Florida Atlantic University's Christine Lynn College of Nursing, in collaboration with the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and the University of Massachusetts Medical School, examined the extent of computer ownership, internet access, and digital health information used in older adults age 60 and above. African Americans, Afro-Caribbeans, Hispanic Americans, and European Americans. The odds of owning a computer or having access to the internet were one-fifth as likely in the African-American group as it was for the European-Americans, and one-fourth as likely for the Afro-Caribbean group. The odds of Hispanic-Americans owning a computer were one-third as likely, and for having access to the internet less than one-half as great as for the European-Americans. Those who received Medicaid assistance were less than one-half as likely to use either the internet or digital health information as those who did not receive Medicaid, and a little more than half as likely to own a computer. And again, this is among people age 60 and above. Currently, digital health technology development is outpacing parallel efforts to conquer the digital health divide, which also has important implications for helping older adults get registered for the COVID-19 vaccine, said Ruth Tappan, lead author. Portals that allow patients access to the electronic health records, decision aids that prepare patients to discuss options with their providers, making telehealth appointments with providers, and so forth, needlessly, though unintentionally, excludes, marginalizes, and disenfranchises those who are older, have low incomes, have low health literacy, and/or are members of minority groups. Okay, well, there's a lot of talk of essential workers in the age of COVID. So, which workforce areas are experiencing the largest disparities in COVID deaths? This from MedRx, the preprint server. Excess mortality associated with the COVID-19 pandemic among Californians age 18 to 65 by occupational sector and occupation, March through October 2020. During the COVID-19 pandemic, working age adults experienced a 22% increase in mortality compared to historical periods. Relative excess mortality was highest in, wait for it, food and agriculture workers with a 39% increase in mortality, transportation logistic workers with a 28% increase, and facilities workers with a 27% increase. So this gives you an idea, not too surprising. And of course, getting food is perhaps the most essential activity you can do in the economy, and that had the highest disparity. One thing you will notice is not on this list is teachers. We get a lot of talk about that because there's a lot of concern. But this partly, I just wanted to provide some context by including that, in that when you see what society's discussion, it isn't always driven by science. The fact is, if we were really looking at essential workers and the risks that they experience and we're trying to mitigate that, we would be talking most prominently about food and agricultural workers. Now, it's not that teachers don't have concerns, but of course, teachers are also a well-organized group, by definition, are well-educated. And in my book, have a long way to go to reach equity for themselves as far as decision-making in their own workplaces. But when you compare it relatively to other areas like food and agricultural workers, there is a huge disparity and a relative lack of discussion in areas that are much more significantly harmed by COVID-19 and other health problems. Okay, well, on this show, you'll hear about data, and that's important in public health. And while there's a lot of things to account for in the COVID-19, you would think one of the easiest things is actually counting a death. That is not actually that easy. And here's this next story from Stat News. Undercounting of COVID-19 deaths is greatest in pro-Trump areas, analysis shows. Tens of thousands of COVID-19 deaths are going unreported in the U.S., with far more missed in counties that strongly supported former President Trump, according to new research. The figure suggests that political leanings have helped suppress the true scale of deaths. In cases where the deceased didn't have the COVID-19 test, a coroner or medical examiner has the freedom to interpret symptoms. Some of these excess deaths are likely due to factors that were exacerbated by the pandemic, such as overdoses and suicide in response to isolation and economic hardship or subpar healthcare in an overrun system, but researchers believe many are COVID-19 deaths that go uncounted. Overall, the true COVID-19 death toll is 44% higher than official figures, according to the study. Wow, that's what I cited earlier at the top of the show, that 44% higher. That's a huge number. And if you add that to the 460,000 plus that we have now, we are already up to over the last 12 months or the 12 months that will end when we have 12 months of the epidemic beginning. It will actually, COVID should be the leading cause of death if you account for the fact that it's not adequately counted in on death certificates. Okay, the researchers found that unattributed COVID-19 deaths were significantly higher in rural areas than urban in the South compared to other regions and in areas where with lower levels of education. All these factors tend to correlate with support for Trump. A total across the country, there were 44 excess deaths that weren't officially recognized as COVID-19 for every 100 official COVID-19 deaths. But the uncounted deaths were far higher in the 25% of counties with the most Trump votes in 2020, with 163 excess deaths for every 100 COVID deaths. That means they weren't even capturing half of the actual deaths. In comparison, there were just 18 excess deaths per 100 COVID deaths in the bottom quarter of these counties. Throughout the pandemic, the response to COVID-19 has been intensely partisan, and the politicized reactions to the virus could easily shape how death itself is recorded. Former President Trump spoke out against testing, falsely claiming that it created more cases. As patients are less likely to be registered as a COVID-19 death if they haven't been tested, this would contribute to cases being missed. In areas where the pandemic is downplayed or seen as a myth, The death reporting process leaves room for those who don't take COVID-19 seriously to leave the virus off death certificates. COVID-19 is typically the underlying cause of death, leading to conditions such as pneumonia or a heart attack that is the more direct cause. In cases where someone hasn't been tested, coroners are free to attribute that to the more direct condition and leave COVID-19 out entirely. The system for recording death in the United States is fragmented. Though most deaths are declared by a doctor, when a patient dies at home and isn't under the care of a physician, either a medical examiner or coroner will typically be called on to declare the death. And of course, this is more likely to happen in cases in areas where they're overrun and people aren't even going to the hospital, for instance. The study led by Stokes found that counties that use coroners who are elected and can be lay people had higher rates of excess COVID-19 deaths than counties with medical examiners who are appointed medical officials. COVID-19 deaths are more likely to be missed in areas of the country where there's less testing. If a patient dies without a COVID-19 test, then it's up to the death investigator to choose to order a post-mortem test. Though both Hess and Aiken have done this for all cases where COVID-19 is suspected, Hess said it's not possible for all coroners and medical examiners to do so systematically across the country. There's just no bandwidth in the system to do that, he said. There's going to be deaths that have occurred during the course of this pandemic where COVID was a component of the death and is not recorded. The cost of ordering a test is also a deterrent, especially in areas where coroners have to pay for post-mortem testing out of their own budget, said Aiken. That's probably not happening in some not well-funded, very rural death investigation system, she said. Even if maybe they've had an exposure, or, you know, maybe the coroner doesn't believe in it, maybe the family doesn't believe in it, they just think that they had the flu or got sick or they died suddenly. Political beliefs and finances aren't the only reasons why COVID-19 might be left off a death certificate. In New Jersey, the state health department declared that COVID should be listed as the underlying, not the primary cause of death. The specific cause, such as pneumonia or heart disease, must be included on the death certificate. Sherry Ben-Simone, a New Jersey and New York funeral director on the board of the Metropolitan Funeral Directors Association, said she's received death certificates that simply state COVID-19, and when she calls to explain that they'll be rejected, the physicians simply switch out one primary cause for another without adding COVID-19 as an underlying cause. I've seen it many times where the doctors will just leave it off, they said. They're exhausted, they're busy, and they have a funeral director hounding them. Unfortunately, said Aiken, even the most rigorous system will miss out some COVID-19 deaths. Most COVID-19 death certificates are signed by hospital or community physicians who get little training on how to sign death certificates. Now, I must remind you that, you know, because there are kind of COVID deniers that, you know, say that, well, you know, you're just counting everybody who has COVID-19 as a death and blah, blah, blah. But what they're doing in this study is they're looking at excess deaths from like the previous years, what you'd expect in a non-pandemic year. So those deaths are coming from something. So if you're saying they're not COVID, you would have to make a good argument for how their other non-COVID-19 related causes. And I've tried to keep a close eye on this. And while we have seen increases in opioid deaths or other drug overdoses, while we've seen some increases in suicides, these are very modest considering the scale of what we're seeing deaths from COVID-19. And actually, we've seen some decreases in deaths like auto accidents because people aren't out and about. So all of that is saying that we have a whole lot of excess death this year, and the vast majority of it is COVID-19 directly related. Okay, but of course, it all is complicated. I want to end on a story where, in fact, we will probably see the effects of COVID for many, many years, and it will not be recorded as COVID. Bum, 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 bum. This from the American Heart Association. Heart disease, number one cause of death rank, likely to be impacted by COVID-19 for years to come. Experts predict the global burden of cardiovascular disease will grow exponentially over the next few years as the long-term effects of the current COVID-19 pandemic evolve. COVID-19 has taken a huge toll on human life worldwide and is on track to become one of the top 3 to 5 causes of death in 2020. But its influence will directly and indirectly impact rates of cardiovascular disease prevalence and deaths for years to come, said Salim Virani, chair of the writing committee for the 2021 statistical update and associate professor in cardiology and cardiovascular research sections at Baylor College of Medicine. Research is showing that the unique coronavirus can cause damage to the heart. Importantly, we also know people have delayed getting care for heart attacks and strokes, which can result in poor outcomes. But Virani said an even more critical issue will be the cardiovascular health risks that are exacerbated by the poor lifestyle behaviors that have been prevalent throughout the pandemic. The extraordinary circumstances of dealing with COVID-19 have changed the way we live, including adopting unhealthy behaviors that are known to increase the risk of heart disease and stroke, Virani said. Unhealthy eating habits, increased consumption of alcohol, lack of physical activity, and the mental toll of quarantine isolation, and even fear of contracting a virus all can adversely impact a person's risk for cardiovascular health. We'll need to watch and address these trends as the full ramifications will likely be felt for many years to come. And of course, what I kind of alluded to before, there is a big unknown because a lot of people, even with asymptomatic or very mild COVID-19 infection, have a lot of cardiovascular ramifications that could affect one's risk over many, many years, even decades of their life. Okay, well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppond.com. And I'm adding a new feature this week for the show. If you go to where the shows are cataloged, you can of course listen to this show or any previous show, or it'll queue up future shows. But on that, I list the time of each of the segments for each of the different news stories. And starting this week, I'm going to be adding a link to news stories. So if you want a further reading or review, you have that as a resource. So you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution.
I need some justice.